Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast. It's for the week of February 22nd. It's brought to you by One World Sports. I'm John Gibson, and with me is Jim Allen. What's happening this morning?
You say February? Wow. That must be Southern California talk. I'm fine, and as critical and annoying as ever.
Southern California talk?
February?
And you want me to say February? Is that what the problem is?
Yeah, but I'm like that too. I've got my own, you know, comfortable and such. So
my parents are from the South, man. And, you know, it's February down there.
Okay, it's February down south.
All right, we're taping on Saturday morning this time. And on this week's show, we've got a chat with the president of KDN Management, Don Nomura. We're going to talk about doping, Shohei Ohtani, and the impact of the enforcement of the instruction rule, and a whole lot more. So let's start swinging.
Where are we going to get more?
Clearing the bases!
All right, so I got to sit down last week and talk with Don Nomura. He's the president of KDN Sports. You know, he was on Volume 3, Show 40 in 2013. So if you want to go back and check out that interview and compare the two, that is probably pretty interesting. We talked about some similar topics. You know, he's made a lot of impact on MPB and MLB, I think, throughout his many years of representing Japanese and foreign players in baseball. Some of his clients on his resume include Max Suzuki. Remember him?
Sure.
He's the kid who went over to the States straight out of high school the way Shohei Ohtani wanted to. But Shohei ended up signing with the Nippon Ham Fighters. So he also represented Hideo Nomo. He does represent Yu Darvish and Tony Barnett, just to name a few guys. So I'm not sure if he listens to the show, but we are fellow tweeps, and we're certainly glad to have him following us. And it was really interesting to sit down and have a chat with him. So let's hear what he had to say. All right, our guest this week on the show is Don Nomura, the super agent. Thank you very much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to talk to us. All right, so when you sit down at the negotiating table for a player, what are the things that you point out to the teams during your talks?
Show me the money. we talk about what the player can do, what he has done, what his role would be, and the length of the contract is very important. Obviously, the amount is. And if the amount is not attained at where we really want, then I think the incentives and being creative is very important.
Do you guys sit down with a lot of statistical data and go through that kind of thing, or do you just, you know, you talked about what the player can do and what the player has done. Is it all about the numbers, or is it mostly about numbers, or what do you focus on?
Well, I think a lot of numbers are discussed at arbitration, more or less. Rather than free agency. You know, stats are very important. How many, for instance, if it's a pitcher, how many innings, what are the strikeout ratios, what are the ground ball ratios, swing and miss ratios, double plays, ERA, wins, you know, all this is important. So, you know, those are basically discussed, and, you know, how they fit into certain organizations, who are they compared to, what are the compared players making. So those are the discussions that we have when we negotiate contracts.
Okay. What went on with the Tony Barnett situation? He was posted last year, and then he ended up leaving as a free agent. It just seemed kind of unique, the circumstances.
We had one club that was going to pay the posting and acquire him. Then at the last moment, they pulled out because they have signed a player with a lot of money. So they didn't have the budget to sign Tony.
Right.
So they backed out of the deal. So then Yakult wanted to keep him on the reserve list until we found a club in the States that would take him. But after several talks with the club, because it would be tough if he's still reserved, and then if the U.S. club has to go through the commissioner's office to check on his status and so and all that.
Right.
So I've asked the club if they can release him. And, you know, bottom line is if he can't find anything in the States, he would basically come back to a cult.
Right.
And that was Tony's intention, was to come back if he couldn't find any job in the States.
Right. But as it turns out, the Texas Rangers showed some interest and you guys got a deal done. And did he have guaranteed money with the Rangers?
Yes, he has a 2-year guaranteed money.
So that's another unique aspect, because a lot of times I know Jim Allen, my partner, has done some research, and not a lot of guys get to go back to the States with guaranteed money.
Right. I think what Tony showed was, you know, not only great stats, but what he has poised on the mound, how he performed under pressure. So I think all that, they have scouted him heavily. A lot of teams have scouted him, and they came to understand that the guarantee was a must. And so we were able to successfully negotiate a 2-year deal with a 3rd-year option, which if he pitches like he does, then he'll be making a lot of money on his 3rd-year option.
Right, right. And we expect good things from him. He has done well. As long as he's healthy, he has been doing well in Japan. So
yeah.
We talked about the current posting system and the way it works. Who do these rules benefit most? Is it MLB or MPB?
Well, it depends how you look at it and what kind of player transfers. So I just cannot say if it's MPB or MLB or the player itself.
Mm-hmm.
But having a cap restricts the Japanese club of getting paid more value on certain players, and the player certainly gets, you know, more money. So it depends who sees it and how they see it from.
Well, how do you see it as an agent?
I never liked posting system, but I think it has been designed better than in the past, when there's multiple clubs that can talk to the player itself.
Right.
And there's a rather than just one team negotiating, you have a little more leverage with having other teams negotiate with.
Do you see it staying this way and benefiting both sides, or do you see it changing and benefiting someone else down the road?
That's a very difficult question, because I think that really comes up between Major League Baseball and NPB. And obviously, NPB would want to change it, and I think Major League Baseball wouldn't want to change it. So, you know, we'll see how that thing goes. But there's got to be some system like this that a player can transfer. But more so, there's got to be a better system for the Japanese player to be posted, rather than they have to go begging for to be posted every year to a club.
Yeah, that's what I said about, you know, Kenta Maeda. I didn't think he should have to, you know, the way the current system stands, I didn't think he had to have a great season and beg for the club to post him, because the amount of money is capped. So yeah. I wasn't clear on that. What was your take on that whole situation?
What do you mean it was capped?
Well, you know, the team can only get $20 million for him in terms of the posting fee, so it's not like if he put up great numbers that it was going to benefit the team anymore.
Hiroshima should have gotten paid.
I'm not sure what they should have gotten paid for him. I would think he's probably, you know, if he, let's say he had put up some fantastic numbers and they could have gotten.
He did. Last year he won the Sal Murray. He had 15 wins, I think.
Definitely won 15 games. But let's say he, you know, he set a team record and a personal record in all the categories you mentioned earlier, you know, strikeouts, double plays, ground ball ratio, not just the wins. And he had a really fantastic season. Don't you think that he would have been worth the same amount of money, let's say, a guy like Daisuke Matsuzaka got for the Seibu Lions?
I don't agree with that. I don't really agree with, you know, if $20 million is fair or not.
Mm-hmm.
What is fair, I have no idea. So I really can't comment on it. But I know Maeda had a pretty good season. He won the equivalent of Cy Young. He had 200 innings, I think, plus, and he had, you know, was second on ERA. And I mean, does that equate to $20 million? I don't know. Yu Darvish was $50 million. Because of the high posting fee they had to pay,
right?
His salary was basically cut. Tanaka, the Yankees, I think, paid $20 million, and then, but his salary was, you know, guaranteed more because of the value that Tanaka held, and the amount that the Yankees had to pay was very low,
right?
Compared to Matsuzaka and Darvish, so.
Right.
You know, it's hard to define if $20 million is high or not, and then also I think you have to wait and see if that $20 million or $50 million is worth it. You know, when the player goes over there, and what is the recourse that the club would get paying $20 million or $50 million in the States?
Right.
I mean, you know. If the guy doesn't pitch one day, what's going to happen? Are they going to get a refund? No. So I don't know if this system itself is perfect. And it's hard to say that, you know, the posting fee itself is fair or not.
All right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, I got you. I know what you're saying. I mean, it is hard to say. We can look at numbers and talk about them all day long, but
I would like to see something like on a percentage fee. So if the player goes along, he the percentage gets paid to the club.
That's a fantastic idea. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
That should be more the way it should be, rather than, you know, giving up a lump sum up front.
Yeah, I see. Okay, now I've seen some of your tweets about Kazuhiro Kiyohara. What's your take on that whole situation?
I'm kind of disturbed and saddened about the affair that, you know, he was using drugs, or I don't know if he was or not, but caught having drugs. It's a shock to me. And I hope when he finishes all whatever comes out, you know, I hope he can revive his, you know, life.
Yeah, I know we all certainly are hoping for that. I mean, he wasn't my favorite player, but yeah, nobody, I mean, obviously people run on hard times, but you know, you don't want to see a public figure like that.
I think it's a message to everybody that, you know, even a superstar can go into this kind of situation, and we have to teach our kids through this that, you know, anything can happen to anybody. So, you know, saying no to drugs is very important, I think.
Now, what do you think about drug use overall in MPB? Because I'm just assuming that there's nobody who's absolutely perfect, so we shouldn't assume that every guy on every team is absolutely out of the realm of using drugs. What's your take on that?
Sure. You know, it really goes into a personal thing, and if you, you know, break the law, then you just have to pay for it, I guess. That's the way it goes, and people should know better not using it.
Yep.
So it's really up to each individual. I oppose to drug using. I oppose to abusing alcohol, you know, anything in that nature. I'm not a big fan of it. Obviously, if somebody uses it and, you know, it goes unnoticed, I mean, what can we do?
Yeah. I mean, I just assume all the guys are clean. You know, when I'm watching a game, I'm just assuming all the guys are clean. Guys, you know, go out and have beers after the game, I know. But, yeah, what's your sense of if dealing with guys? You think most of them are?
I think so. I think they understand the consequences of being caught, you know, even in the States. And yet some players still, I think, abuse some drugs, and they get caught and they get suspended, and just life goes on. There's going to be guys, and there's going to be totally clean people, and some guys have to use it or have used it or something like that. But, you know, I'm not a judge to that.
Right, right. All right, talk about brighter things. Now, we have Pacific League TV on internet, and you can watch it on your mobile device. We've had that for a little while here. We've got some streaming this year of camps, some live streaming on the internet. So do you see NPB working to become more global?
I don't know if it's NPB. I know it's Pacific League.
True.
but I think they have to go global. I think they have to be more conscientious about not only Japan but surrounding countries, to work closely more with Korea, Taiwan, China, to promote baseball, promote marketing, and really seriously think about growth of baseball itself.
Yeah, do you think NPB, at least, I know the Pacific League is pretty progressive, and you said not NPB per se, but I think NPB is trying to head in the right direction. But do you think it is as an organization?
I think Pacific League is, because they are trying a lot of things, as to the Central League hasn't really done much. And when you look at that, you totally see two different leagues there. And then you question, what is the commissioner's office doing?
Yes, you do.
So I think, you know, somebody has to put both leagues together as one and, you know, have a strong band, and 12 teams should profit from whatever they do. I mean, that's what they're here for, to profit and promote the game and to better the game itself for the fans and, you know, market their products, which is baseball.
Which we very much enjoy.
It should be better.
Yeah.
It should be more exciting. I'm not a very big fan of Japanese baseball, but, you know, with the new young managers, I hope they kind of have a different sense of the game itself.
Okay. Well, we have a great sense of appreciation for you taking the time out to chat with us. We really enjoyed the talk. Okay. Take care. We know you're busy,
right.
So thanks a lot.
Easy.
All right.
Good luck.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, so thank you very much, Don. We really appreciate the time, and he's got a lot of things on his plate, so I know he was busy, and but the fact that he would say, "Show me the money," that to start out the interview, that just tells me that him delivering that line means that he is kind of comfortable being on our show. Although in that movie, it really wasn't the agent who was delivering that line; it was Cuba Gooding who was playing the role of the player who delivered that famous line. But anyway. What stayed with you after hearing the chat?
Well, quite a bit. Mr. Nomura and I agree on so many things. I think our constant point of contention is the Japanese Players Union, which you guys didn't talk about. So that's, I'll leave that one for another day. in the sense that they did this, and every time I said, "Well, they managed this," and he said, "They managed nothing." They haven't done anything. They're, you know, and then it goes on and on. He that's his diatribe hot button, I guess. So
yeah, I think in that first interview that we did on the show, that's what he talked about at length. I think there was the weakness of the players' union. But yeah, go ahead.
So I thought it was very interesting, and he and I have a similar viewpoint on, you know, how much a player is worth.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the sense that, you know, it depends on what you're looking at. And there's basically two points of value, two points of observing the value of a contract. One is at the entry point, when nobody knows how it's going to come out, and you're dealing with, is the team paying value that a comparable player would receive?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now this was a point of contention with the Oakland A's with his client, Hisashi Iwakuma.
Right.
When Iwakuma was posted and they could only negotiate with the A's, and I recall that the A's selected two players as comparable, one of whom was Kei Gawa. And Nomura and his team selected two players, one of them was not Kei Gawa, but was Colby Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't recall the other players involved, but yeah, there was a little bit of a gap there. And I can see the point of view of including both of those players, Keikawa. Anyway, that's a long story, but the whole point is that the question, and very much as it is with Major League arbitration, is who is this guy similar to? And that's really how they develop the entry point value.
Mm-hmm.
And then the market will decide whether, you know, whether we need to pay more at this time or less at this time. So, I mean, when you get somebody like Maeda, you know, it seems like a contract, like the kind of contract after his heart. You know, in the sense that it was a small front-loaded contract with a lot of incentives,
right?
But and the question of how much, you know, how much he was worth in a posting fee was, it was a great answer. I wish I'd thought of that. You know, who knows? Who knows? And I certainly don't know. I try to look at the market to some degree and think, oh well, this is the amount. You know, this is the kind of value they're getting for these players, so it should be worth more, it should be worth less, but the fact is nobody knows. So I was quite interested by that. Yeah, so, you know, he said, is the Japanese team going to give a refund if the player they post doesn't pitch in a single game?
But no.
No, but are they going to get, you know, are they going to get paid more if he's an all-star? No. So, you know, it's part of the same thing. And that's what that reminded me of is there are occasionally major league trades where if a player is used more,
right,
you know, it's on the roster for, you know, there are player incentives in trades where if a player is used more than originally expected, then an additional player will be sent at the end, you know, to be named later, will be named a year later, or another amount of money will be paid to the team and so on. But being Japan and NPB aren't the same organization, it's really hard to do that.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, that compensation or determined by performance, that would be a good aspect. And I thought that was a great comment by him saying, hey, look, we let the player perform for a season. And then even then, I still think it's very difficult to come up with a price.
I think it is.
Yeah, I think we'd have even more negotiation with that. But I think that's a great starting point.
I'm not keen on the idea of, well, let's see, you know, pay him, you know, based on what he does this year, you know, pay the team, kick back so much to the team based if we use him this much or this much or this much, because it's just so, I don't know, it's really radical. And maybe that's why I haven't quite digested it. My position that I thought of, I guess, when MLB imposed this, MLB, the Yomiuri Giants and the SoftBank Hawks imposed this system on everybody,
mm-hmm.
is that the better way to do it would be to do it the way soccer teams do it around the world, which is you have two sets of negotiations. The players negotiate with teams they want to play for. Uh-huh. And then if he has a team he wants to play for, and basically they're aligned, then that team will then negotiate with the club on a price. So the player negotiates a price, the team the order doesn't have to be fixed, but basically everybody agrees. The team agrees on a transfer fee. The teams agree on a transfer team on a transfer fee. The player and the team and the other team agree on a contract. You know, what's this? Why does it have to be one team that's so Major League Baseball exclusive, non-competitive, non-free market, you know, old-timey solution?
Yeah, I remember you saying that before, actually on that show that in which Don appeared. So, yeah, you know, there's a lot of ways to go about it. I don't know the perfect solution. I just think that the solution that we have right now is not perfect. But
no,
I have to admit, he got me in this talk because, you know, I like to shoot off my mouth about, you know, things like when guys should retire and how much a guy makes and who gets underpaid and who gets underpaid. So when
you don't shoot off your mouth, John.
Sure, I do. And anyone who stands in the way. So when I, you know, he stopped me dead in my tracks when I talked about the cap on the posting fee. And, you know, this goes back to, as you were saying, the team's negotiating. And he says, you know, what's a fair amount then? What do you think the team should have gotten for Maeda Kenta Maeda? And I said, well, I don't know what he should have gotten, but I didn't think it should be capped. And just like as he was explaining, and he used the word beg, you know, the player has to go and beg the team.
Yeah.
To post him, and I just don't think that's right. And I, you know, if a guy is ready to go and he has shown, which we're going to talk about later, he has shown that he maybe is not bigger than the league, but he has grown and he can expand his growth in an area where in an environment in which it's going to require that he expand himself and grow, then I think that's better for the player eventually. And why not let him go? But, you know, I didn't spit out a number when Don challenged me because I don't know either. I just don't know about it being capped. I agree with you.
I don't like the idea of caps and quotas. And it's because the market's going to decide what is necessary.
Right.
And the caps was put in place because, well, here's the funny thing. And here's the silly thing. The caps were put in place to allow small market teams to compete for Japanese players.
Right.
But then they're in a free agent situation where they can't compete for Japanese. Yes, it's irrelevant. It's completely irrelevant.
Right. They're out of the frying pan and into the bigger fire. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Bring your sunblock or something.
One thing I did consider, though, was, for example, if they set players, they rank players here into maybe two or three categories, like a double A level player who's like a very top level.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cap for those guys would be at 40 million.
Mm-hmm.
That's an arbitrary number, of course. And then an A-level player where the cap would be at 20 million, and then a B-level player where there's a minimal posting fee, which can be negotiated. And I think if you set those, if you got top-level players, guys who do X number, I mean, you set some benchmarks just like they do with the Sawamura Award, and you set the benchmarks, and if these guys hit them, of course, then you have other issues, like the team doesn't want the player to steal too many bases or try to hit too many home runs.
put a damper on that guy.
Yeah, yeah, slow down, buddy. But you've got these other things. But, I mean, you know, they should be able to make the move if they want to. So I'm thinking if they can categorize these players and then put them in a certain, rank them, and then have a posting fee that's not maybe equivalent, but I mean, that's more fair, because not every player, some players are going to be worth more than 20 million to a team, and some are going to be maybe right at 20 million, perhaps. But you can't, you know, my point was you can't say that necessarily that Kenta Maeda and Masahiro Tanaka should have been at the same level.
No.
And that's where they are. And I don't think that they're at the same level, but, nope. So I understand, you know, the agent's position, and you know, I know there's a finite pot of money out there, and you don't want to make the teams rich, you want to make the players and the people who are around them more profitable, and the contract is how they do it. And if the major league teams are paying most of the money to the Japanese team, then there's less money to go around in the pot. So I understand
And of course he was. He and I, this oddly enough, Mr. Nomura and he wanted to talk about this when he was negotiating with Iwakuma, with the A's. And the day sort of that thing died and he went back to Rakuten, it was like he didn't want to talk about it because it didn't serve his, you know, he had that iron in the fire and he wanted to sort of publicize that. And as soon as it was no longer on the agenda, it was like, oh, old story, sorry.
Right.
I said, no, it's a big issue, but it wasn't a big issue to him the day after. He wanted to drop that issue like a hot potato. He had other things to, you know, other fish to fry. So,
who would blame him? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's an agent being an agent. You know, he's got work to do and publicizing an issue which isn't going to help him in the next 6 months was not a winner for him.
I totally understand. I totally see the point.
He talked about putting both leagues together, which they more or less have done. But, you know, it should be better. It should be more exciting. I'm in agreement with that. I've long said, you know, I've really liked so many things about Japanese baseball, but watching how poorly Japanese baseball markets it is really sad.
Yeah, and that's the next thing I was going to get into. I loved his comment. I mean, he dropped a couple of bombs. One of them, he has said in the past that NPB doesn't do a good job of marketing the sport. And mm-hmm. then the other one was that he seems kind of frustrated with the way Japan goes about playing baseball, or the approach that is normally taken in Japan. And he pointed to the new managers and saying that he hopes that they bring some new ideas and new styles to the field. Mm. And I like that. But yeah, I think bringing up the fact that the Pacific League has Pa League TV and he said, yeah, well, the Pacific League, not necessarily the Central League and not necessarily NPB. And you're right. They're not working together. It's like the left hand doesn't care what the right hand is doing.
Well, in an ideal world, I think it is better that the leagues do things differently.
Why is that?
Well, because you get to see what they're doing differently. You get two different experiments going on at the same time. And I think it has helped the Central League that they've done it differently. And the way it's helped the Central League is the Pacific League is experimenting out of necessity. Mm-hmm. And they've come up with all these ideas that the Central League essentially has adopted and would never have tried on its own. If the Central League was, you know, if NPB was forcing both leagues to be, you know, the lowest common denominator the way the Central League is, we wouldn't have interleague play, we wouldn't have playoffs, we wouldn't have all this stuff now that makes Japanese baseball a little more interesting.
Yeah, but you say two experiments going on at the same time. What is the Central League experimenting with? Because I don't see it.
The Central League is the control group. What happens if happens if we give them placebos? No, I'm serious.
I'm in agreement. No, yeah, because they're not doing anything.
Right, exactly. They're not quite doing anything, but they're sort of blowing. The commissioner's job is to keep other teams from infringing on the business models of the big clubs, the biggest clubs.
Yeah, I guess I would equate the Pacific League with like a hamster or a rabbit or something you can see grow that jumps around and makes a lot of effort to do something. And the Central League is more like a plant.
Hashtag high heat.
You know, it's growing, but unless you use time-lapse photography, you don't see any differences.
Yeah, pretty much. You should watch it. And then you watch the comments that the Central League owners make every time the Pacific League comes up with a new option. That'll never work. You know, it's the 180-degree turn is the norm.
Right.
That'll never work. But wait, when can we do that?
Right.
It takes usually about two or three. They basically, that will never work. And then when it's implemented, they say, well, that's stupid. And then the following year, it's let's do that.
Right. After a year watching the success or the change or the excitement or something. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there was this this event in 2004 when the Giants played. The Giants were winning the league. Or I forget. I'm going to say it was 2003 or 2004, but the Pacific League had introduced playoffs with announced starting pitchers.
Uh-huh.
It was a game between the fourth place Fighters and the last place Rakuten Eagles. So it was after 2005. It was after 2005. I'm going to say it was 2005 or 2006, and the same day that the Eagles were playing the Fighters, 4th to 6th on the 20th of September or thereabouts, the Giants were playing the Yokohama Bay Stars, and they played in a crowd in Yokohama of about 6,000 on a rain makeup day, and the Eagles, the last place Eagles, drew a crowd of 30,000 to Sapporo Dome.
Right.
Because of the playoffs and because Yu Darvish was pitching, and it was announced that Yu Darvish was pitching. And the Central League had said, well, none of that stuff's going to work. And it was the following year when they said, oh, we want the playoffs too.
Right.
So
Control group. I love it. I love it. So, I think Don was pretty busy. And, when he said that about Japanese baseball, I wanted to delve into it more, but I knew he had to go. And I think we spoke for about 20 minutes. So I think we had taken up a lot of his time, but we appreciate it. And we look forward to having him coming on again and talking about more aspects of Japanese baseball.
Well, that's the thing, that he is so busy. And we, most of my exchanges with him are on Twitter. So, which is always often quite fun, often quite fun. But so I would like to have Vaughn as, like on a weekly basis, I think would be great fun, but we can't manage. None of us could manage that.
Right. One thing I wanted to, I'm not exactly clear on it either, but he mentioned the reserve list, and I know that he put Tony Barnett on there. And I just wanted you to quickly explain that to people who don't know exactly what it is.
The reserve list is is basically the list of players who are under contract or who have the team has a right to extend a contract to, and have offered contracts to. Okay, so if a player there's a 70 man roster, the team is allowed to offer contracts to 70 players, and usually this is by the end of November. If they haven't a certain date in November. If the team has not offered you a contract, then you're a free agent. So basically all I have to do is send you a contract. And then if you haven't declared yourself a free agent, you have not filed for free agency, or you haven't retired, then you'll be on the 70-man roster if the team so desires. So in this case, it was a case of actually Tony Barnett had a right to refuse any contract the Swallows offered him. And become a free agent anyway.
Right.
And he chose the posting system as a way of repaying the Swallows if a major league team should be interested.
Right.
So the Swallows wanted him to stay on the reserve list, as he said, but it would have, it made things more difficult. And I think it was mutually advantageous to everybody that things, worked out in this sort of adult fashion.
I think so. I think so. And it worked out well for him and guaranteed money to go back to the States. So we're watching you, Tony. Good luck over there, man.
We are. I think it says it speaks well for both him and for the Swallows. So
definitely. Definitely. Okay. Thanks a lot again, Don. And we look forward to having you on again. Now, I want to make a two-steam transition and talk about Shohei Ohtani and the Nippon Ham Fighters. They wrapped up their Peoria, Arizona spring training, if you want to call it that. But actually, they did have spring training because I saw on the news that one of the players came back and said, "Ah, it's freezing here in Okinawa." I'm like, "What are you talking about, man? Come up here to Tokyo, where I'll show you some real fake cold."
Hashtag I hate.
But now let me preface this by saying, I'm not privy to any inside information or anything. I'm just trying to connect the dots. But Ohtani had a superb spring, it looks like. He drew a lot of attention.
I'm
still trying to figure out why they had to go over to Peoria for the first time in 29 years. I'm sorry, first time in 29 years having their camp abroad, not necessarily in Peoria, Arizona. But I'm just trying to connect the dots. I guess it's my, I watch too many detective shows on TV probably. Of course, they show too many detective shows here in Japan, so I come by it honestly.
You might have come by that dishonestly. I'm glad you cleared that up.
Connecting the dots. He had a great spring, apparently. A lot of scouts came to see him. We joked about how many scouts were there and that each team was able to save money sending, or that was your comment that lots of teams were able to save money by not having to send scouts over here. They saw him hit, they saw him throw, blah, blah, blah. Now, let's say when Nippon Ham convinced Ohtani to sign with them out of high school, because he assured everybody he was going to go to the States right out of high school, and he said, "Don't draft me." But somehow Nippon Ham drafted him and then convinced him to sign. And now this year, by coincidence, the Fighters are camping in Arizona. And here's the kicker. We talked about it with Don Nomura. The posting system agreement expires at the end of this season. The wording I saw was at the end of the season, not necessarily the year. But even if it's at the end of the year, the actual posting would take place early 2017. Somewhere around there, I think.
So I think that's still in the works. But anyway, I haven't heard much about a new agreement. I guess we're going to hear about it during the season. Now, what if the reason that the fighters were camping in the States is because they know that agreement is going to expire and that there's going to be changes in the posting agreement, and that the fee might go back to what it was before, where it's uncapped, or it's much higher than it is now. And maybe they had an agreement, let's say, with Ohtani. One of the reasons they were able to convince him to sign that contract is because they said, when you think you're ready to go to the States, we will post you.
You mean giving him Darvish's number 11 wasn't enough?
No, it wasn't enough. And yeah, this is one of the best kept secrets. I mean, I asked a couple of friends who are reporters, one of whom you know, and you know, nobody really knows what was in that contract. That's like,
well, that's, as I don't know if I mentioned last week or you know, 4 weeks ago, but that's the norm. The people who know what's in a player's contract are usually the player and the team.
Yes. So this
MPB don't know, the union don't know. You know, Mama don't know.
Okay. So, you know, by coincidence, again, connecting the dots, the fighters are camping. Everybody gets a good look at Shohei. The posting agreement is going to come up at the end of the year. And he's really looks like he's ready to put, I mean, he learned a change up while he was over there from Trevor Hoffman. He's ready to put up some great numbers. What if this is his last year in NPB?
Well, that's possible. I think it could be. I don't know if that's the case that it has to be or what the conditions might be. I haven't broached this with, as I mentioned the last time you brought this topic up, I haven't asked Toshi Shimada about this. Like, but it's again, he always answers he usually answers the questions or he laughs. If I ask him one that he won't answer, he'll go, I can't tell you that, but he does. You know, even when I asked him, like, what'd you do with the Darvish money? I expected that kind of answer. And he said, oh, well, nothing. We've got it. We've most of it sitting in the bank. But so I guess it would be interesting. Now, from what I understand of the current posting agreement, it has, in order for it to be terminated, it has one of the sides has to give notice 3 months prior.
Mm-hmm.
Which, and I believe, would make that August.
August or September, either one.
Yeah, in that area. Well, a little earlier, probably August. That they want to terminate it.
Mm-hmm.
So and to start a new one. So I can't imagine NPB doing anything active or proactive in August. You know, it's sort of like not part of their routine. They sort of figure things out in the off season.
Right.
And if had they been talking about redoing the posting system in August, we would have heard about it in the winter, because none of these guys can keep a secret.
Right. And like I said, I don't know. I don't anticipate it.
I don't either.
But I just looked at, you know, it just seemed weird to me that all these things were coming together at once, isolated on their own. Oh, they're having camp overseas. Oh, how nice, you know. And then, oh, the posting agreement is going to expire this year. Oh, well, that's, you know, we knew that in 2013. You know, that's just a different. And then Ohtani, we know he has a desire to go over to the States. Mm-hmm. He has said it. He said it from the start. It's no secret. And again, since we don't know the terms of the contract, all we can do is speculate. So I'm speculating. I mean, you know, why not? It's brilliant. No one sees it coming. It's a conspiracy theory, I know, and I've got no way to prove any of it. But 3 months in advance, if we start to hear murmurings in August, I wouldn't be surprised. And what if they can negotiate it through the end of the year or into the new year, and then perhaps work, you know.
They won't negotiate it through the end of the year for this off season, because that would mean people posted in November would be under different situations than people who are posted in January. I don't see that happening. They'll want it for the entire off season. The other thing is the other possibility, as I've mentioned in the past, that there could be there are, you know, the posting system is wide open for potential loopholes.
Okay.
And the one I've mentioned in the past, which mentioned, I talked about with Don Nomura to some extent, and also the Japanese Players Union and also NPB and MLB, is that there would be no way to get around a Japanese team saying, well, if you want to go to the majors, you should go as a free agent, and this is how much it's going to cost you.
Mm-hmm.
Work out a deal where it'll cost you X amount of money to buy out your contract. So I would think a player, when you get every scout, his brother and his his wife's cousin showing up in Arizona to see Shohei Ohtani, there's a lot of money there. There's a lot of interest.
Yep.
And I would think if I was a betting person with capital, that I would invest a lot of money to help Shohei Ohtani buy out his contract.
Okay.
So, right. So I think there's that possibility, and that there's no violation of the posting system if they say you're a free agent.
Right.
Okay. Because we had that issue with Masahiro Tanaka when he said he wanted to kick back money to Rakuten, and MLB said, no, you're not making the rules here.
Right.
So, okay, the other thing I want to mention about Ohtani before we move on, not a conspiracy theory, but I did a story. I did talk with Fighters scout Matt Winter, who was just eating this up, that, you know, Japanese reporters were coming up, what organization are you working for, to see what do you think about Shohei Ohtani? He says, I work for the Fighters.
Right. he's never seen him. Yeah.
Yeah, he's our guy, you know. We're happy to have him on our team. We
back
got
off. Yeah.
Yeah, take a hike. So Matt wouldn't say that. He'd say, hey, you want to buy me a beer? So anyway, I was thinking about Shohei Ohtani, and we were talking a lot about his hitting, because mostly what the scouts in America saw was him batting. Uh-huh. And apparently he opened some eyes with his hitting. And he had a really rotten year last year. But I still think, you know, and I'll mention this again, going back to 2013 when he was a rookie, about the number of extra base hits he had.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, who had, you know, similar, I've talked about this in the past, that it seemed like a fairly large number. Well, he had 10% of his hits, 10% of his at-bats, he had extra base hits.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Which is, you know, it's not an outstanding number, but for an 18-year-old. If you look in NPB history at the guys who had 15 or more NPB at bat, 15 or more extra base hits at the age of 18, there are 11 guys now, including Shohei Ohtani. And of them, 3 are in the Hall of Fame, 2 are eligible to be in the Hall of Fame and should be elected, one of whom is the aforementioned Kazuhiro Kiyohara, and another is Kazuyoshi Tatsunami. Another is Masahiro Doi, who should be in the Hall of Fame, but isn't by an accident of fate. And there's a couple of other players who are of similar situations, great, great players who aren't in the Hall of Fame. But basically, it's 8 guys who had Hall of Fame caliber careers, Shohei Ohtani and 2 other guys.
Right, but those guys were full-time position players, right?
Were full-time position players. So here we've got a guy who can really hit.
Right. So we got a part-time position player who put up these numbers. So yeah, you've always talked about it. You know, I've always pushed him as a pitcher. You've often complimented him as a hitter while respecting him as a pitcher as well. So I just want to see him have the opportunity to, like I said, that's all I've ever said. Like to see him have the opportunity to do both, even at the major league level.
Well, I think that might happen. I think that was... you know, I think that spring, and he might have a better year at the plate this year. I mean, Matt was very impressed with his approach and actually his and a number of things. But of course, he said, how can you have a guy who throws 100 miles an hour and not want him in your rotation? I understand that part.
Right.
Okay, here's the last bit about Shohei Ohtani, is that while he was he was left off the national team, which we'll get to in a little bit, for the March exhibitions against Taiwan in 2 weeks' time. He was, however, he did have a discussion with Hiroki Kokubo, the manager of the national team.
Mm-hmm.
And according to Ohtani, it said, in the future, Kokubo said, well, if you're not pitching, I think you ought to hit. because when he pitched against the major, you know, when he was pitched against the major leaguers 2 years ago, he wouldn't let him hit.
Yeah, I did see that comment.
Right, so I thought that was kind of interesting. So I think that might have had to do with how well he's been hitting this spring, too. He's just been ripping the cover off the ball. So
yeah, he's been doing well. All right, making a seamless transition. We did touch on this a little bit with Don Nomura. I just wanted to talk about the doping issue. You know, we've only ever really seen two imports be popped for doping in PB, and that was
right.
Daniel Rios of the Swallows and Luis Gonzalez of the Giants.
Rick Guttormson.
Oh, Rick Guttormson. Yeah, and
yeah, okay, so, when he was with SoftBank.
Yeah, he got he had a masking agent.
Yeah, he said it was the hair growth
thing, yeah.
That some people have gotten popped for because it's a potential masking agent, so it's banned.
So those three guys we've had, but no Japanese players, although Hirokazu Ibata, the Dragons, was fined, and the team was fined, and I think that was 2011, and in 2009, I think it was, Kazuki Yoshimi had an issue, and I don't think anything ever came of it. I think he had garlic injections or something like that, so.
Right, well, it's the vitamin B injections, which are actually more garlic than vitamin B, but okay.
Right, so, you know, I went back and I, the same friend, reporter friend, I asked him about the testing, and the testing is done.
Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't changed. I don't think it's very random. Actually, they have set days that they're going to test. But on those set days that they're going to test, what they do is they have a lotto drawing. And
right.
It could be two players from the same team or player from each team.
Right.
But two players are tested before the game. And yeah, they're doing what they can. You know, I talked to Don about it, saying that I hope that players are not using. And, you know, as long as you don't get tested, you won't get caught. So if it's completely random like they do, you know, it's viable. Or it's conceivable that a guy could maybe just not be tested.
Sure. Well, yeah, of course, I think you've probably had the experience as well as, you know, you're waiting for the player after the game to talk to the media and the PR guy will come up and say, sorry, he's having to do a drug test.
Right.
That happens a couple times a year.
Yeah, once in a while. Yeah.
As for Japanese players getting busted, I guess we have to mention Yusaku Iriki.
Uh-huh.
He got a suspension in the States from when he was in the minors.
That's right. Yeah.
He was taking something. He was doing some sort of a performance-enhancing drug to help recover from an injury while he was in the minors. And I guess the other one is a case more similar to Kiyohara's is Takahito Nomura. Now, he's the former Blue Wave Giants, Milwaukee Brewers, and Fighters reliever.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to prison in 2006 for using meth. Now, he said that he had started to use this. He started using amphetamines because some quote unquote foreigner with the Oryx Blue Wave got him started on greenies.
Uh huh.
And then he kept using them when he was with Milwaukee. I guess he kept using them when he was with the Giants as well. That's when he was a teammate of Kiyohara's. Anyway, so he in 2006 he went to jail. He went to serve prison time for drug use and possession. And apparently, the minute he got out of prison, he revealed this last week, or you know, he said this last week. Whether you know how much of it is true or not,
we don't know, right?
Yeah, he said basically the second he got out of jail, he got a call from Kiyohara asking if he had ratted on any of his teammates.
Oh no! Oh so, no! Yeah, I'm, you know me, I always say it. I always look at everybody with a clean slate, and I just think that everybody's innocent until proven guilty. But I know that's very naive, but that's the way I want to look at it. And I just hope that testing is good enough to catch the people who are doing it.
Yeah.
If they are doing it.
The other thing, and I'm going to go back to what Matt and I were talking about the other night. One of the things I didn't put in the story about Shohei Ohtani was he was talking about the enforcement of drugs in the States, making it more likely that some Japanese position players will be able to make. I know you've talked about this. He was saying, you know, I think it'll be easier for Japanese position players in the future because of the drug enforcement, because they're not going to be competing against, you know, second baseman or hitting 40 home runs.
Right. Yeah.
So that sort of changes the playing field.
Okay. All right, let's make a four-seam transition and talk about the obstruction rule or the enforcement of the obstruction rule,
yep.
which if you read the Japanese newspapers, they're calling it new rule, the new rule.
That's right. the new rule that's been in the books for 100 years.
Right, so we refuse to do that on this show. We're going to call it the enforcement of the obstruction rule, like what it is.
Right.
So I wrote a blog post about this as well. I think it was about 2 or 3 weeks ago, but I was scanning stories and I saw a lot of confusion out there about what was happening. And I considered it strict enforcement of the rule, something you've correctly pointed out many times on the show.
Well, there is a new rule, of course.
We're talking about the obstruction rule, but we're talking about no new rule that has to do with obstruction.
No, the new rule is that the runners are not allowed to target the catchers.
Right.
Okay.
So I saw a lot of comments out there, and it just seemed like many of the coaches and players are just looking at this as an opportunity to run wild on the bases. I saw one comment from Lions skipper Norio Tanabe, and he said, "I feel this new rule is going to heavily impact baseball." Seibu Lions battery coach Masanori Taguchi said, "It's going to develop into a situation where the runners are going to rule the bases." They're going to rule the bases.
Yeah. Well, that's
reign of terror.
It sounds like Bud Selig talking about free agency. It wasn't Bud Selig about who is the Bowie Kuhn talking about free agency ruining baseball.
Right.
As we know, baseball's dead because of free agency 30 years ago.
Right. Hirokazu Iwata, the aforementioned, now he's a Giants coach, and he was saying that it's gonna make the umpires look bad, especially on throws from the right side, because they're gonna be out of position and blah blah blah.
I mentioned that recently.
Yeah, other people said the runs are gonna go up, and they're just looking at this as an opportunity to increase scoring and increase outs on the base paths, if you ask me. But they're saying they're going to be sending runners and that it's going to change the game. How much do you think it's going to impact the game this year?
Well, I guess the first question is, how often do you see the catcher blocking the plate without the ball?
Very often.
Well, I mean, like how many times a week? How many times a week do you think it happens for one team? Once a week?
For one team? No, yeah. More than that. The catcher?
Twice?
Maybe three times. I would say every other game. Almost. I mean, because there's sometimes that it happens twice in a game.
Okay.
So I would say three times a week, yeah. 2.5, 3.
Yeah, well, you watch quite a few more games than I do. So So let's say that's three runs a week.
Okay.
Okay, well, that would be a half a run a game.
Well, we're talking about at the plate, but they're talking about everywhere.
Yeah,
on every base. And yes, it looks like these coaches want to send these runners to every base.
But those rules were enforced everywhere except home plate. They're not changing anywhere else.
Well, but they said even on touch plays, they're not going to be able to block the bags.
No. If you have the ball, you
without
can block
the ball.
But nobody blocks the ball without the bag, without the ball. Nobody blocks the base without the ball. You slide into the bag. Nobody puts their...
I think some of the guys at second base on steal attempts tend to cheat. They throw something down in the way
before
the ball actually gets there. I said tend to cheat. I didn't say they do
it. You see a little bit, but it's pretty...
They push the rules.
It's pretty slight. I mean, basically, you're not allowed to obstruct the... You know, and the obstruction rules have been an exception. They're the home plate. And that's why MLB years and years ago added the phrase catchers are not allowed to do this too. It says it's rules. Do not exclude catchers. They're part. You know, they're just like everybody else. So So let's say I don't think it's going to have a huge impact. I think maybe a half a run to a little. You know, a fifth. I was going to think it happens about once a week. But here's the thing: are they going to send them more? Well, they already send guys who are out by 10 feet.
So, especially the Eagles.
Well,
last year's version of the Eagles.
Yeah, if I'm an umpire, I just want to rule the Eagles guys out when they get on base.
Hashtag
I'm just gonna save you risk of injury.
Let's just save us all some time here.
Exactly. Why waste your time, son? Go back and get a better plan.
I'm sure the umpires are saying, we can get these games done in an hour and a half if you really let us work here.
Exactly. Well, but, you know, for me, the interesting thing is less the rule, because the rule's pretty straightforward. It's just, you know, they're moving from an area where it was grayer, where it was completely gray. And umpires were allowed to call people out without seeing. And then this is the bit about throws from right field. I mean, I don't think it's going to change any. Umpires basically, when the throw is coming for right field, the umpire sits behind the catcher and can't see the tag.
Right.
And so they routinely call guys out when there are no tags.
Or safe when they can't really see what's happening.
Yeah. And I asked about that, said, we don't need to see. I asked Takeshi Hirabayashi, the former AAA umpire and current member of the umpiring technical committee, and he said basically, what tag? We don't need to see no stinking tags. We're umpires. If we think there's a tag, there's a tag. You know, get out of here.
You're out.
Exactly.
You're out for saying that.
He's a great guy, but he's a really, he's a typical umpire. We don't make mistakes. The fans make mistakes. Cameras make mistakes. Players make mistakes. So I bring this up. I think the interesting thing, as I am in agreement with Ibata, that the interesting thing is going to see how the umpires do this. I think the variety of is going to be bizarre. We're going to get umpires who basically ignore the rule, as always. We're going to see catchers who are going to cheat and umpires who are going to let them cheat.
Yeah.
And now here's the thing. This year, they're going to introduce instant replay at home plate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They're expanding instant replay to include catches against the outfield wall, home run balls, and close plays at the plate. But here's the kicker. Now, Hirabayashi-san told me in June or July last year that, contrary to the media reports in the U.S., American umpires loathe instant replay.
Mm-hmm.
They hate it. They wish it would go away and drop dead.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Along with those who challenge them.
Exactly. Because they know what they're doing and they're better than any cameras, according to Mr. Hirabayashi.
Mm-hmm.
So now the plays at the plate, while the manager can come out and question calls against the outfield wall and home run balls, the managers cannot ask for a call on a replay on the play at the plate. The umpires have to do that. So how often do you think we're going to see that? Does the word zero?
Does the word zero register? No.
Like, what day is hell going to freeze over? That's mean. I think there will be umpires who will say, look, I had no chance. And his partner will say, look, let's get help. Let's do it right. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
And it won't be the day hell freezes over, because I don't believe in hell.
Okay. All right. Let's move along here and make a transition to spring camps. Just a few notes. Daisuke Matsuzaka pitching with the SoftBank Hawks the other day. He threw, had a session, had no pain afterwards.
Had no control, but no pain.
Yeah. No, nothing. It was a non-bullpen session. Hiroshima Carp pitcher Hiroki Kuroda is trying out a changeup this year at the age of 41, so that's good. He said he wants to be able to attack hitters in the strike zone with an off-speed pitch. Okay.
Yep.
All right. Bring it on. Yoshinori Sato, the hard-throwing, or used to be hard-throwing, Yakult Swallows right-hander, who's been plagued by injury after injury after injury. He had signed a development contract with the Swallows this past offseason, and he's gone to a three-quarter throwing slot. And he hit 148 kilometers per hour in a batting practice session, and he's trying to get back. He wants to still pitch.
He's trying to get back to what, 161?
trying to get back to the top team at some point.
I was gonna say, that's
161, it. I don't see it from three-quarter, but you never know. All right, speaking of numbers, Cebu Lions pitcher Ryoma Nogami threw a 402-pitch bullpen session.
That's
Nage Komi. Why?
He felt good is usually the answer you hear. I felt pretty good after throwing 350. I figured, why not some more?
What I was wondering was, why did they pick 402 pitches to stop him? I guess his batting average against between pitches 333 and 393 was really high. So they said, we better get him out after another 50 pitches.
Hashtag high heat.
My guess is that he was doing really well. And this is, I'll be honest, that he was doing really well. And so somebody went over and told the manager on the other field or in the gym or something, told Tanabe to come over, and he was doing really well. And it's getting to be about 350 pitches, and Tanabe came over and he says, okay, now I'm going to air it out. I have seen that. The manager shows up and the pitcher snaps to attention.
Oh, no.
Oh, somebody's watching now. I got somebody's attention. Now I'm going to show them. But this is often followed by news that the pitcher in question, who led the team in pitches in the bullpen, is going to, he felt discomfort in his elbow in a March 12th preseason game, and he's going back to the farm team.
Yeah, well, we'll be looking out for that, because that's probably on the horizon for Mr. Nogami. Matt Merton, by the way, he did sign his contract officially with the Cubs, so it's a minor league deal, and I think I'm not sure if he's got an invite to the...
Yeah.
He does? Okay, he's got an
invite.
Well,
he did, when he told me he agreed to terms. Now, this was, I think, February 4th, he agreed to terms with the Cubs on a minor league invite, and it was conditional on his passing a physical.
Okay.
Which he said was unusual for minor league invites. But anyway, so he said it's official. Now I assume that means that the minor league invite is still official.
Okay. And then Samurai Japan, the Japanese national team, had its selections, which were announced this past week. And no big surprises other than most of the guys who were going to start on opening day probably were left off.
Yeah, because the best pitchers in Japan can't figure out how to adjust to pitching 10 days before opening day. I do not get this. What I do get it, because it's the team saying, we have to prepare him carefully for opening day because it's the most important game of the season. It will decide, God, what brain dead sports editor at the Yomiuri Shimbun comes up with lines like that? Goodness, man.
I don't know. You want me to go down and check tomorrow?
Yeah, ask him. Ask him who wrote that horrible story about Ichiro in 2012. Goodness me.
All right, let's go to fielding questions. All right, this one comes from Ben in Tokyo, and he says, while I've been watching Japanese baseball over the past 15 years or so, I noticed that there's a lack of rally culture when it comes to the bottom of the ninth when the home team is trailing or the game is tied. Have you seen anything like what MLB stadiums do with the rally monkey or motivational movie clips in any MPB stadiums?
How about you?
Me? Never.
I think it's so true.
Ben
yeah.
pointed out the lucky seven stuff that he's seen in the seventh inning where the home team, they don't sing take me out to the ball game or anything, but they get up and do some whatever. It's unique to some stadiums. Most of them have balloons and stuff, and they let the balloons go. And
they usually play the team fight song.
And, yeah, they just take a break to drag the infield, you know. No, I haven't seen anything like that. I think, you know, rally monkey stuff like that, that's a slice of Americana. That's like expecting to see guys slinging peanuts and hot dogs in the aisles here in Japan, because they don't do that either. As much as I'd like them to do that.
Hey, watch out for that.
Peanuts? I mean, you never
sushi.
Hear that. Yeah, they're slinging some sushi at you, but you don't have a lot of the vendors. It's just a different culture,
yeah.
And it's not this culture, and I've never seen anything like that, and I really don't expect it to see it here in Japan. It's like throwing the salt in sumo wrestling. I mean, they use the salt to purify. So the most I've seen is salt on the dugouts.
On the dugout steps.
On the dugout steps when there's a team in a slump and they're trying to purify something. Other than that, if we're going to see something and if you want to push something, it's not going to be anything like that. It's going to be more subtle. And I remember when Larry Rocha was working with the Chiba Lotte Marines and they started to do a lot of different things in that stadium, but nothing radical, nothing like, you know, getting a rally. What would they have over there, a rally wave or something going on in the ninth inning? But Ben, I suggest you get out to a game, get a group of people and start something.
Well, the other thing is, you know, I had the pleasure of talking to a number of people who worked, Japanese people who have worked for American sports teams. One of them now is working for the Fighters, Mr. Yuta Muto, and he told me about things that he's done and things he's picked up from his associates and his experiences when he used to run the scoreboard for the Houston Astros.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a very big thing, and he's talked about, you know, implementing things and coming up with new ideas, and certainly that's one thing one direction they can do. They're always open to new ideas, at least in the Pacific League.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Japan, there isn't a rally culture. There's a chance culture, you know, where they have the chance theme, and the Oendan system in Japan allows for some real individuality. Because I remember 20 years ago, I used to sit in the Jingu outfield a lot. And, you know, despite my really bad Japanese at the time, it was a hoot. You know, before the inning, a young guy in a hoppy coat would come up, introduce himself as the section's cheer guide for that inning. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those guys seemed like they were training to be stand-up comedians. And, you know, the guy come up and says, you know, we've been getting our butts kicked tonight by the whales of all team. Who would have thought it? But we're going to believe it, even though we look like we've been swinging wet straw instead of bats and we've run the bases like we had our heads up our, well, you know, this is our time. This is when your swallows will show what they're made of. So let's go and give them a hand, you know.
Blow that guy up.
It was so funny. These guys were hilarious. And I really love that, but again, yes, it's all private. It's all individual stuff. It's all the Oendan sort of thing. The teams are like going, oh, that's more stuff for us to do. I mean, that's how they treat ballpark entertainment. Oh, that's extra work for us.
And by the way, the Oendan are the organized cheer groups we spoke about on the last show. So, yeah. Yeah, no. So like I said, Ben, if you get out there and start something on your own, we'll expect to see you. I think you're in Tokyo, so at a Swallows game or at an area Kanto region game that we'll know it's you. All right, here's another question from the Graveyard Ball guys.
The Cebu Lions promoted Tetsuya Shiozaki to be their head coach from being the farm manager. Is it possible that 2016 could be viewed as a transition year, where Nori Watanabe is a bridge for Tetsuya Shiozaki waiting in the wings? And if so, does that mean that Nori Watanabe will be let go no matter how the season ends for the Lions? And he could be just another free agent? Or could he be moving to the front office, similar to how Hisanobu Watanabe, better known as Nabe Q, where he is currently at?
Okay, Tetsuya Shiozaki. All right, careful with your pronunciation there. Careful. Yeah, you know, they tagged along an article with this question, but the article came from 2015, last year, and it was talking about the aspects of whether they made the playoffs or not. Maybe Nabe was not going to be around, and I call him Nabe 2 as opposed to Nabe Q. This is Nori Watanabe, the current
manager.
You know, I don't know what's going on in Cebu, and I haven't liked it since the moment that we saw a lot of change. We've been seeing a lot of change there, but when Nabe Q decided to suddenly step down, and that they didn't win that year when he stepped down in 2013, and then they brought in Ihara, and then that didn't work out, and Tanabe took over part of the way through, and then he had his full season last year, and you know, it just doesn't seem like there's a lot of plan execution. Maybe there's some plan in place, but there seems to be a disconnect. I don't like what I'm seeing from the organization. So I don't know. You know, they lack some depth in on the player side, and I think that's why they weren't able to finish in the playoffs last year. Not because of Nabe too. It really wasn't his fault. I just think he was shorthanded. So if they think Shiozaki can make a difference,
then that's them. I look at Shiozaki and I say, meh. You know, I'm not really sure that he's the answer. I think it's more personnel.
First of all, I have no idea what the Lions might be planning. I haven't talked with Nabe Q in quite since sometime last summer. But if I were the Lions, I'd be thinking about replacing Tanabe. You know, they made another change this offseason. They brought in former Eagles and Giants coach Hideki Hashigami as a tactical coach. Now, he has a reputation as being a smart percentage guy. He was that way when he was a player. You know, good on-base percentage, good percentage base stealer, and so on and so forth. And he's a disciple of Katsuya Nomura and was selected as the tactical coach, a very late addition to the 2013 World Baseball Classic coaching staff. There's another story there I won't get into. But now Shiozaki had been Watanabe's choice to succeed him. But I'm guessing that Haruhiko Suzuki, the chief baseball guy and a former infielder, didn't want another former pitcher in charge.
Right.
And then picked his former teammate, Haruki Ihara. Now, Watanabe told me 2 years ago, after that first Ihara blow-up and Tanabe recovery, that he had had zero input into the selection of Ihara, but said, I'm going to speak my mind next time. And so that's kind of interesting. The third thing is that the way Tanabe managed in the closing days of the 2015 season was pretty weird. And I'd almost think I would be looking for a new manager the second I saw that nonsense.
Yeah, but that probably was also an organizational decision as well. I don't think he did it on his own completely. So.
Yeah, but the Lions have a weird history with that stuff. You know, dating back to let's have Matsuzaka pitch in Cebu Dome because we don't trust Nishiguchi when he was our best season. You know, he was our best pitcher, and let's pull Nishiguchi out of a game so Matsuzaka might get a win.
Yeah. All right. Well, this has been probably the longest show in JBW's history, and we have some more comments and other things, but we'll get to it next time. We will see you in another 2 weeks. Thank you very much for lasting all the way to the extra inning, JBW, and we'll talk to you next time. Enjoy your preseason.
Talk to you later.
Live and exclusive from around the globe, America's network for global sports, One World Sports. Win this top soccer competition, including Europe's iconic clubs, Arsenal, Bayern Munich, Chelsea, and new this season, Juventus. With exclusive highlights, interviews, and analysis. Plus, NASL's greatest soccer franchise and 2015 champion, the New York Cosmos. Watch One World Sports on your TV, tablet, or smartphone. One World Sports, a sports network like no other.